My name's Amy and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 11th, 1995. I got sober when I was 24 years old, and I'm coming up on 24 years of sobriety. So it's almost been half my life now that I've been sober. It's been an amazing half of my life. I had this belief for many years that if I didn't get sober, you know, being so young when I did, that I would have had a totally different life, a not so good life, and being so young like that. And, that thought has resonated with me for a long time, and it was confirmed a couple of years ago. I got a phone call from someone from my past, and they were calling to inform me that someone I had dated out in my disease had passed away. This man passed away at 47 years old. He passed away from alcoholism. And I really could have had a different life, because that man asked me to marry him, and something in my being at that time at 24 years old said, just say no. And, you know, I got sober right after that. And so that really, you know, drove things home for me and made me very grateful that I am sober today and that I chose the path that I did in my life at that time. I did a lot of the things we do out there. My disease took me to places, I left my house at 18 years old to live with that man. And that was a very abusive relationship that I was in. And I remember making sober decisions in that relationship, that I did not want to feel no more. And because it was just a lot. And I needed drugs and I needed alcohol to do that, to push those feelings down inside of me. And, you know, even growing up, I had those feelings that we have as alcoholics, like, you know, I'm not good enough, or, you know, there was times where I didn't feel like I fit in my own family, and I felt really out of place in school too, and I just had that, you know, the wired thinking that we have as alcoholics. And I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I know that today, because, you know, most of my family is still drinking. And, you know, and I watched that, and I said a prayer a couple years ago, because I was just kind of done with my family's alcoholism, and I said, I want family and Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was my prayer a couple years ago. And my cousin got sober. He has about 3 years now. So there's two of us that are sober and Alcoholics Anonymous in my family. And so it's a real blessing today. I really have had an opportunity to look at the alcoholism in my family. My dad passed away recently, and I've had to spend more time with my family over the last few months. And, you know, I'm, you know, thinking sober thoughts, and they're, you know, doing the opposite of what I think might be the right thing to do. I felt that it was really my responsibility to do things right in that situation, and so I've been having to be of service to my family in that respect, and doing a lot of research for them also on different business matters. At 18 years old, I dropped out of college, and I thought that partying was a far better idea, and it really was at the time. You know, that was, you know, my thinking as an 18-year-old alcoholic, and that, you know, I like to talk more about recovery than I do about, you know, my disease, because we all know how to drink. And you know, in sobriety, I had the opportunity to go back to school, and I have 2 degrees today. And I have an amazing life in Alcoholics Anonymous because of the guidance of, you know, a sponsor and the guidance of people in the rooms. Literally, you know, as a young adult in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have people, you know, our old-timers, you know, thank God they were there. They would say things like, you know, Amy, did you enroll in school? Amy, did you go enroll in school? And they would say things like that to me, you know, as a young adult. And, you know, I had that that guidance that we have here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm forever grateful for those people that God, you know, put in my life today and that are still in my life. I mean, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my bottom. I got married out of my disease, and you know, in that marriage, I saw my friends going off and having these wonderful lives, you know, buying beautiful homes and having families, and you know, I was in alcoholism in my marriage, and you know, I remember waking up one day and noticing those things, and it was more of a reality check, because I had a miscarriage. I got pregnant, I had a miscarriage, and you know, I just couldn't, you know, live with myself, because I knew what I did, and I knew that I caused that to happen. And so it was a reality check for me, and you know, I saw myself one day waking up, and I saw myself for the liar I was, the cheat I was. You know, I was had a minimum wage job. I wasn't going anywhere in my life. I was, you know, uneducated when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really didn't have any long-term goals. A lot of people have lists of things they want to accomplish by the time they're 24 years old, and I was flying by the seat of my pants, having a good time, not caring about those things. And I really didn't care about those things. And so, you know, and that my priority was to party. And but having that miscarriage and seeing myself, you know, I remember drinking one night, and the drink stopped working. I would go through the motions of drinking and the motions of doing other things, and I was just ingesting things. I mean, it stopped working. I couldn't get high, I couldn't get drunk, and it was just, you know, ingesting chemicals into my body, but nothing was happening. And trust me, I did try a couple times before I, you know, that's a really scary place to be, you know, in that cycle where you can't even, you know, numb those feelings anymore. And knowing that, you know, the only option left is sobriety and not doing this anymore, because it doesn't work anymore. And it was an interesting experience to have that. And yeah, I just stopped one day. I just stopped because I knew it wasn't going to work, you know. But I didn't, you know, get to Alcoholics Anonymous right away. You know, my ex-husband was still drinking, and I couldn't live there anymore, so I had to leave. And so I didn't get to Alcoholics Anonymous until I was 9 months sober. I'm going to say dry is the correct word, because I didn't have any recovery in me. I was crazy, but at 9 months crazy, I was, you know, willing to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. my ex-husband ended up getting sober about the same time and went to a treatment center in Minnesota and told me the only reason, you know, the only way I can go out, you know, live with him again is if I went to 3 meetings a week and had a sponsor. And that's, and this program put our marriage back together over time, and we were happy for 6 years. And you know, he decided to go out and drink at 6 years of sobriety, and I wanted more, you know, more recovery at 6 years of sobriety. And so I had to leave again because I didn't want to get drunk. And that's pretty much what it came down to: do I want to be married, or do I want to be, drink? That's what it came down to for me. And I wanted to stay sober more than anything. And so, you know, I've been off on my own now. I have almost 24 years of sobriety. I've been on my own. I've gone through school on my own. I've have an amazing career, an amazing life today. I get to be of service in Alcoholics Anonymous at, you know, a level that I never expected. I do a lot of general service. And, you know, I got to fly out last year, and I got to meet our staff at the General Service Office in New York. And I thought that was just amazing. It was an amazing experience to do that. I got to spend 3 days with them. And just having that experience in general service has helped my career, because that's what we're dealing with in general service today, is the business of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, and we have this saying that, you know, if you want to be a mature person, join general service. And if you want to own your own business, join general service, because those things will happen there just because of what you're dealing with. And you're dealing with the business of Alcoholics Anonymous, and those things have happened for me. I know I'm a mature person because somebody told me that. And, you know, I don't think that about myself. Literally someone said, "Amy, you're a mature person now." And I said, "Thank you." And so I know that's happened. And, you know, I went off and I have my own little business today. I started that this year. I went on an avenue I never thought I would in my life, you know, being someone who, you know, had no education and watching people do these things. And, you know, I get to do the things that I watched, you know, when I was out in my disease today. And I think you come to a point in your sobriety where you're showing your growth. You don't know that you've grown because you're just doing it, and you're just showing your growth by, you know, people coming into your life saying you're a mature person, or, you know, you get a sponsee that went through something, you know. I have a sponsee now that, you know, went through something when I was 15 years sober, and she's going through the same thing I did. And, you know, I see her codependency. I was so codependent at 15 years sober. And now I'm not that person today. And I'm grateful for everything that has been given to me in my life today. You know, I'm just letting you know my life isn't perfect. I have alcoholism in my family, and I get to deal with that today. And I have, you know, just life happening. My father passed away. Those things happen when you're sober, and you get fired from jobs. You get sick. Just because you're sober, it doesn't mean life isn't going to happen to you. But the only difference is today you have tools to deal with those things. You have friends to walk you through that if you don't know what to do. And sometimes, you know, you get to experience, you know, a lot of firsts by trial and error too, and that's a real experience in itself. And I'm grateful for that opportunity in my life today, and thank you so much for having me here today. My name's Amy, and I'm an alcoholic. Our main speaker today is Carla.
All right. Hi, everybody. My name's Carla Rowell, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to start by thanking Bill for the invitation to come out here and share with you guys this morning. It is always, I hope I never take for granted, the privilege and the opportunity to come out and participate in Alcoholics Anonymous in any way, really. My sobriety date, September 25th, 1987. And before that, I never did anything for 31 years in a row on purpose that was of any value. You know, I had to come to AA to get a life. And since then, Alcoholics Anonymous has put me on the game board to be able to face and meet the challenges that life brings, like Amy was talking about. You know, the promise that I would learn how to live life on life's terms sounded pretty good to me. Because it just seemed, you know, up until then, alcohol had done just that for me. It helped me, it either made the terms look different or it made me feel like I had already dealt with them. And then it stopped doing that. And I had to come around or die. Slowly but surely, Alcoholics Anonymous. I really love the benefit, the effect that Alcoholics Anonymous has on me, and so I'm going to keep doing it. But I hope I never take for granted the grace that I've been afforded. You know, the gap between my efforts and perfection, you know, in the middle of that is a whole lot of grace, a whole lot of trying and making a lot of mistakes and getting to be here anyway. But number one and beyond, above all of that, is that I've been able to stay sober since September 25th, 1987. And so thank you for the opportunity, Bill. And thank Amy for coming over last night. She spent the night at my house so we could get out early this morning. And I kind of abandoned her at about 8:15 because I'm an early go-to-sleeper and a very early riser. So and then she took the trip out here, and it was just beautiful. You guys live in a little bit of paradise out here, so thanks for having us. I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I used to think it was a very important question to try to answer. You know, was it my crazy, dark, dramatic, violent, perverted family? You know, if you had my family, you'd drink too. You know, I almost couldn't wait. to do my fifth step with my sponsor because I was sure she was going to say, oh, no wonder, you know, but she didn't say that. She didn't do that. You know, she gave me some more stuff to do, but I've been around here now long enough to know that is not what made me alcoholic. You know, I know people in Alcoholics Anonymous who live charmed childhoods. You know, nothing happened to them. My husband's one of them. You know, his family grew up singing together and loving each other. And you know, his dad painted the family pickup truck the color of his high school. You know what I mean? They're that family, you know. And yet, he sits right next to me in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why? Because alcohol did exactly for and to him what it did for and to me. And I don't know why that is. And again, it wasn't always the way I felt. Lots of non-alcoholics feel different. That's sort of the human condition, you know, feeling we separate ourselves from God and then from each other, and we can all go through that. However, what does separate me is that when I drank about my feelings, when I drank about them, alcohol did something for me that was so profound that it doesn't do for those non-alcoholic people. And so I continue down that road. I still get fascinated at the way non-alcoholics drink. You know, they just don't seem to care. They just don't seem to care about that drink sitting in front of them. And I was about 17 years sober when I really, really got it. And I used to go out dancing, ballroom dancing, West Coast swing, whatever it was you wanted. I was out there. To go West Coast swing dancing, you had to go to a bar sometimes because that's where they played the country music, where you could go Dad, do the dance. And that is where I realized that there is a faction of people who actually go to those places for the primary purpose of dancing. You know what I mean? Like, they don't care that there's a drink sitting in front of them. They will let it sit there all night till the straw is crawling up over the side of the glass and the ice is gone. They may or may not touch it the whole night. And that's when I really got it. They drink different than I do. And on the other hand, you know, there's a story in our book about Fred the accountant. He's one of there's Jim the car salesman, and then the man of 30, and then there's Fred the accountant, who was having a great weekend. He was not having a bad weekend. He wasn't feeling different. He was feeling right in the groove. Everything was going his way. And then what did he say? I think I'll have a cocktail. And that guy ended up going way off the rails that weekend. So, you know, it's not really, we like to tell ourselves, you know, it's because I was feeling bad. It's because of what you did. It's because of, you know, but if alcohol didn't have that effect on me, I would have left that alone and did it a whole different way. You know, but alcohol does something to the alcoholic that it just doesn't do to 90% of the population. You know, and until I was able to get that, I don't know if I would have been able to stay, because the stakes would not have been high enough for me. You know, if I didn't understand, and I fought for a long time. When I first heard that portion of chapter 3 read in one of my first meetings, I got it, man. You guys drank like I did. I tried everything, every imaginable remedy to make sure it was not the alcohol that was doing it. It wasn't the alcohol. It was you. It was it. It was that. It was if only they would do it my way. When really simply, man, no matter how I feel on a good day or a bad day, when I take a drink of alcohol, it takes the next. I've got this physical allergy, this literal physical allergy to alcohol that happens when I'm drinking, and this obsession to drink alcohol that happens when I'm not. And those two things together were ready to kill me. But I came in here and you taught me how to treat the spirit. I treat my spirit and I got better. The obsession to drink alcohol was finally removed. And I didn't have to take that first drink, no matter what's happening in my life. Because I got to remember this too. There is never going to be a day where I am going to be so spiritually fit that I can take a drink of alcohol. That day is never going to come. No matter how good I get, no matter how virtuous I look, there's never going to come that day as an alcoholic. Like that old adage says, once you're a pickle, you'll never go back being a cucumber, right? I'm a pickle. So... You know, and there are just so many different analogies. I remember hearing about this young lady when she was 16 years old, living over in Iran, I believe. Her name's Molala, and she was 16 years old, and she was shot in the head because she wanted to get an education. But she never became an alcoholic. That's a pretty rowdy way to live, right? That's a pretty rowdy thing to happen. She didn't become an alcoholic. She just moved on. She moved on with her life. She got better. So I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. And the circumstances certainly, the longer I stay here, I realize the less they meant. I just love the effect produced by alcohol, and I was willing to follow it into every dark corner of the earth and willing to do anything, betray myself over and over and over and take down the ones I loved and anybody who loved me for the effect that alcohol produced until it threw me away. And that's why I'm here. The stakes are high for us as alcoholics. Anyway, I started drinking young. I know that there are a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who came in here having built and lost great empires. You know, they made something of themselves and then they lost it. You know, that is not me. I peaked out at about 11 and a half and then skidded across the bottom till I was 29. You know, and then I came in and I was pretty willing. The obsession to drink alcohol wasn't lifted for me till I was about 9 months sober, and so I'm just living proof that you can be in AA for about 9 months and not feel like it, and it can still work, you know. And then all of a sudden, after some step work and in the middle of making my amends, that obsession to drink alcohol was finally lifted, and it hasn't returned. But I know what to do now if the obsession were to return, to stay close and do all of these things that these silly things that seem so silly, especially when we're new, right? Go stack the chairs or cook breakfast. Oh my God, you guys, thank you so much for that great breakfast. Wasn't that great? That's just terrific. And I don't know if it's the same crew who does it every month or what, but it's just a wonderful thing. And didn't you forget about yourself for about, you know, those couple hours that you were working? You know, we forget. When I'm stacking chairs or cooking breakfast or shaking hands or doing something for somebody else and not getting caught, I start to experience the absence of the noise on the inside of my own head. Just for a minute. And that's where I want to get a lot of the time, you know. And you guys, I learned that here. A lot of people learn that other places. But I, as an alcoholic, alcoholism was the catalyst that brought me into the vehicle, Alcoholics Anonymous, that just shot me into the fourth dimension, which is the ability to be in the here and now and present for you in life in whatever form it may come. Whether I like what's happening or whether I don't like what's happening, I get to be present. That's amazing to me. That is amazing. So I started drinking early, and you know, home wasn't working for me. I got my first social resentment behind a game of spin the bottle. I know they don't even play that game these days. They just get right down to business, don't they? They just zoom right past. And we were at my friend Leonard's house. It was that summer between junior high and elementary school, you know, going up into, they call it middle school now, but we were at my friend Leonard's house, and we were passing around a bottle of his dad's whiskey and a few boys, a few girls, and the bottle we were spinning landed on me, and I went off into the bedroom with one of the boys, and we were both doing the same thing as far as I could tell. But when we came back out of that bedroom, they called him a player and me a slut. And I did not think that was fair. You know, I still don't think it's fair if you want to know the truth. But every sponsor I've ever had has told me that the fair comes around once a year and it lasts 2 weeks. That's all you get for fair. So, you know, and I just really didn't understand what was going on. It wasn't like I wanted to become a playa either, but I just didn't understand how is that not fair? You know, what? How come him and not me, you know, and all that. And that stuff is still going on, But so I got my feelings hurt, and I got a reputation in junior high I didn't understand, nor could I take responsibility for it. And if I hadn't been so self-centered way back then, maybe I would have found out at some point that there were a lot of girls doing way more than I was doing, you know, but I thought it was only me. And so I let go, and I started to back away from my life, and I started spending more time in the girls' room than I did in the classroom and hanging out with the other girls who were doing the same thing. We'd bring stuff from our mother's medicine cabinets and from their liquor cabinets and hang out until after a while school wasn't working anymore either. And I am a roll your sleeves up, take over the management of my life kind of girl, you know, and I've been that way since I can remember. I've always believed in God, since I was a small child laying in my bed. But whenever some challenge would come down in our family, I took over the management. I pulled the shade down between me and the sunlight of the Spirit. I did that. Any spiritual awakenings or anything I might have had, whenever they could be intervened by alcohol, I would use that instead. And back to the spin the bottle and the. So I started to leave home. My favorite place to be way back then was on my way to somewhere else. Love that place. I'm going to do it. It's going to be better up the road. Hope is just up the road. And so I started to leave home. And consequently, because I was so young, I started ending up in some of the Southern California hot spots like Indio Jail and Riverside Juvenile Hall and LA Central Juvenile Hall. And we did that whole dance for a while. And when I was 14, I left home one more time with a friend of mine, and I was always heading for San Francisco back then, because I was 12 in 1969, so the 60s were over technically by the time I got out in the world. But I kept, you know, I'd see them on TV, and those people didn't take any crap. Those people of the 60s, right? We got 60s people in here, I know. You know, they stood up, and they marched, right? They marched. They didn't. They said no, and they played that beautiful peace and love and marching music. They were strong and unified, and I loved them. So I kept heading to San Francisco, you know, and we got one long ride all the way up into this little district called North Beach, this little party town, this area of San Francisco, and the guy dropped us off, and we were just kids, you know, bright lights, big city, and we looked to my left, and there was Carol Doda in neon and her flashing boobs, and she was a famous stripper, and to my right were hookers and dealers and pimps, oh my, and we weren't on that street for 10 minutes before a couple of guys approached us, offered us money for sex, and we said yes, and did the next indicated thing, and boom, a whole new career path opened up for us. And I started living a day at a time in a way I've not had to live in a very, very long time. And Dr. Silkworth talks about this in the chapter, The Doctor's Opinion, in our book. He said that after a time, we can't differentiate the true from the false. After a while, our alcoholic lives seem the only normal one. And it certainly seemed that way for me. I didn't realize it at the time, but I had already begun to trade away every God-given talent or gift or potential that I had for the effect that alcohol produced. And if you had asked me back then, I would have told you I was doing it willingly. Alcohol intervened in my life in a way that nothing else could. And as I discovered that, it became my growing up muscle. It became my spirituality. It became the thing that made me feel connected to you and the thing that made me feel buffered from you all at the same time. Why wouldn't I? Why wouldn't I pick up another drink? So a year later, I ended up in a mental hospital. I was supposed to be there for 2 weeks observation. I ended up being there for a year. I just sort of made myself at home and moved on in. And they were not talking to me a lot about alcoholism at the time. They were talking to me about disorders. I was a very disordered-looking child, alternately violent and withdrawn, and living with a level of frustration down in my gut I did not know how to talk about. In fact, it wasn't until I got to AA almost 15 years later that I heard a tape of who I now know was Cubby Selby talking about feeling like a scream looking for a mouth. And I thought, oh my God, you know. But I didn't know anything about this then. And this was not a treatment center, it was a mental hospital. So a lot of my roommates had real illnesses, real manic depression, real schizophrenia, the real thing, you know. And untreated, when I've got no booze or steps or fellowship or God of my understanding, I look a lot like them. It takes a little while to sort that out, you know. So in the meantime, they're giving me daily nutritional supplements, Thorazine, Melaril, Valium, Dalmane sleepers. I suppose they were concerned I wouldn't sleep. And I had become intimately familiar with five-point restraints, and that's what I looked like at 15. And if you don't want to go crazy in the nut house, you got to get busy. And one of my favorite ways to be busy back then was the boys. I loved all the boys. But my favorites are those sexy smoldering types, you know. You know the kind. They just sit back there and simmer, don't they? And you just never really knew when they were going to blow, you know. Right? Right? Yeah. I know we got some of those guys in here today because I can see the smoke curling up from the corners. I know you're here. I used to find it very exciting, but today I know that feeling is fear, so I stay away. But the trouble with guys like that is that they're usually hiding from a junior prison sentence in the nut house. They don't want to go to California Youth Authority, so they're trying to lay low, you know, but they got nothing. And eventually they blow. You know, like my first boyfriend ended up blowing up and throwing a big chair through the big plate glass window of the boys' unit. My next boyfriend ended up blowing up and throwing a nurse through the big plate glass window of the boys' unit. So that was progressive too. And I don't know about you, but I've always thought I should have a soundtrack to my life. You know, music playing in the background of all this drama going on. You know, like maybe one day Bob Dylan following me around singing a ballad, you know, just tangled up in blue. And maybe another day a mariachi band just, you know, setting the mood for a fiesta. You know, and maybe another day just flat out rock and roll, you know, because it's just like that, you know. We used to play those sentimental jailhouse songs like, "Who, when will I see you again?" And press our little faces up against the big bay window of the girls' unit, looking out at them, looking back at us. Living in that sweet spot of anticipation. You know what I'm talking about. If only, as soon as I, when that happens, it's always right there, isn't it? Right there. Because as soon as I get it, I think, what was I thinking? Right? It's got to be right out there. Just right past the fingertip. In the if only. I did not understand what I came looking for, I came looking with. I didn't understand. And in every spiritual tradition I ever take advantage of looking, availing myself of, I find that they say the same thing. The kingdom of God is within. Look within. Our book said, Bill Wilson said, deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. In the last analysis, it's only there he may be found, only down in here. But I was always looking out there for what I thought it was going to be. And the trouble with that is I'm always about half a bubble off what it is I think I see anyway. You know, like I'd mistake arrogance for confidence. I'd mistake sex for love. I'd mistake brute strength for strength of character. And I'd get it up in my hot little hands and it dissolves where I stood because it wasn't it. And I betrayed myself over and over and over and over again. And I can still do that. Selling our bodies is only one little piece of the puzzle. We come in here and we grow up and we start to wake up and learn how I sell myself out for the things I think I want, for the things I think I need, for the things I think I'm not going to get. You know, what does our inventory say? Where was I selfish? Where am I self-seeking? I love the term people-pleasing, right? Because, as my friend Ron says, how many people did you actually please doing it? You know, let's stick to what it really is, self-seeking. Because otherwise, why am I trying to please you? You're right? So, I'm in it for something. But I didn't know any of that, and it just seemed like such work when a drink would make me feel like all that was taken care of anyway. It created and preserved illusions for me. Why wouldn't I continue to do that until it threw me away? And I was locked up most of my adolescent life, and I never went out the front door at most of the places. It was juvenile hall in between for a couple months, 3 months, 4 months, always sitting in front of a judge waiting for placement. You might as well have stamped it on my forehead. My dad used to say, I think they're just trying to buy you some time, Carla. And maybe he's right. You know, I come from a family where my baby sister committed suicide at the age of 17. My baby brother died of drug addiction and alcoholism when he was 30. My mom passed away 10 years ago, July, of end-stage liver disease. And my last remaining sibling lives in Wisconsin, and when she's not drinking, she's on the Vicodin maintenance diet. So maybe, they just held on to me long enough for me to be able to, you know, skid across the terror into finding you guys. I don't know, but I feel very, very lucky there. I don't believe God loves me more or chose me over. Sometimes I think that He lets the really tired ones just go home. That's how I look at that. They just get to go home. Again, like I said, I hope I never forget the grace that I've been afforded. Grace not because God loves me more, but because that I know how much worse this could be. I know people have walked in these circumstances and had much more dire consequences, and not for any reason except that something happened. I got lucky. So at the end of that, I was in a girl's home and still searching, you know, even though alcohol was working so well and some other things too. But, you know, I loved heroin for a little while. I loved crank for a long while. But those things I was able to walk away from, I drank through them. And alcohol was the thing I could not let go of. It was the thing I just couldn't let go of. And so I was in this girl's home and I was reading books by Baba Ram Dass, trying to figure out what Be Here Now means exactly. And we were talking to our friends one more time about San Francisco and the kids of the 60s. And they said, oh, man, that's all over. You got to go up to Oregon. They're all in Oregon now. So we went out the second story window of the girl's home, down the tree and into Randy's truck and off to Oregon where God might be. And I don't know about you, but I never went anywhere new thinking, let's go screw this up too, right? I always went somewhere new thinking, fresh start, clean slate. We're going to get it right this time. We're going to do it right. Pay attention. Going to get back to the land, right? Now, I'm from Los Angeles, so I don't know what land I thought I was getting back to, but I was going to get back to the land, and my friends rented a house. They let me come with them. We planted a garden in the front yard, and that's when I learned that in Oregon, when they talk about hoeing, they meant with a tool. It's a whole different thing. And two things happened while I was up there that I certainly couldn't see while it was happening. And one was that we'd go without drinking for a few days. You know, we didn't always have money, and I was a terrible thief, and I just trying to lay low, you know. So we'd go without drinking for a few days. And when I had no booze, I had no steps or fellowship or God of my understanding, no sufficient substitute. I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. My relationship with alcohol already so developed that when you take it away for any amount of time and I've got nothing in there to replace it, my life quickly becomes your fault. And I am absolutely no fun, and eventually you're going to ask me to go. And the second thing that happened was when I could drink the way I needed to drink, I was always overshooting the mark. Even at 17, I couldn't guarantee if I was going to have 2 or 22. Couldn't ever count on it. Could not count on it. And I didn't even see that happening. In fact, I kind of thought that I wanted it to happen. You know, it's just like, that's just how it was. And my friends had asked me to leave, and I was asked to leave a lot. And I ended up in my father's house one more time against his better judgment. He really thought it was a bad idea, but he let me come anyway, and we just lasted a couple of months. Right before my 18th birthday, he came to me and he said, you know, I'm not going to watch you die, and I'm not going to help you do it. You got to go. And on my way out the door, all I could remember is that one of the counselors at the rehab had told me I was a great actress. And I know today I must have misunderstood, because I ended up on Hollywood Boulevard, and there's not a lot of auditioning going on out there, I can promise you that. And I was 18 years old, starting my days off with a pint of pop-off vodka and just go wherever the day took me. Some days it was a party and some days it was just surviving, and not a lot of hope about it getting any different. And a few months into that, I met a man walking down Hollywood Boulevard, and I saw the light in his eyes, and I didn't realize it was orange sunshine, but we hit it off, and I moved in with him that night, and I didn't even know his last name, and 6 weeks later he's asking me to leave, and I still didn't know his last name, but I like to bring him up because years later he was on my 8-step list. He was someone who came to mind very quickly and clearly. His only crime had been trying to help me, you know, and I had been that proverbial tornado in his life. I went through his life in 6 short weeks, spiritually, physically, materially, mentally, and every way. So much so that when you have to put somebody out, you know, and say, you got to go. So, in my first year of sobriety, he ended up on my first inventory. You know, I just love when some of those people just come clear. You know, they just come right back clear. I knew. And after I made that first round of amends to my family, I went looking for him. Later on, about 9 or 10 months sober, I started looking for him in all the places where I might find him. And of course, I didn't find him. It had been years. And finally, my sponsor said, you know, you got to leave that alone. If you're supposed to find that guy, you'll find him, but in God's time, not yours. You know, now you're kind of chasing your tail, so you got to leave it alone. And you know, go ahead and keep doing what you're doing, and try being a friend to a man in a vertical fashion. You know, go ahead and do that. You know, not that, you know, to tell you the truth, I did not need a lot of convincing in that direction when I got here. I knew that when I got here, you could not use the words Carla and good character in the same sentence. I knew that. But I also knew that I had no self-respect, and I saw it in some of you. And so I listened to little nuggets like that, because even though they're not in the big book, they were really great truths, you know. So I saw what that looked like. Right before my 13th AA birthday, I had to go give a talk on the other side of town, and it was a hot Sunday afternoon, and I didn't feel like going, and thank God you guys have taught me it's not how I feel, it's what I do. If I said I'd be there, go show up, you know. And I love that. I love that today still, you know, because I was a person that could blow off a dinner for two and think I wouldn't be missed, you know. It just didn't seem like, you know, but don't dare not invite me, you know what I mean? You got to invite me, but I'm not going. That's how it was. So showing up, even today, all these years later, I get a great satisfaction, because if I don't feel like it, if I'm afraid, if I think, oh, what am I going to say? How are we going to go? How's it going to go? All of those things. Now it's just like, thank you for sharing, and I show up anyway. But anyway, I went to this meeting, and of course I felt better after the talk was over, and the meeting, the thank you line came through after the meeting, and this man stopped and he said, where were you in 1976? And it was a guy from Hollywood Boulevard standing in front of me with 8.5 years of sobriety, and I with almost 13. And only a very well-organized, loving spirit of the universe could have made that happen when I, in all my efforts to get it done, couldn't get it done. Even if I had somehow wrestled that to the ground and made it happen in my first year of sobriety, he wasn't sober yet, so maybe he wouldn't have got it quite the way he did when he had a little sobriety under his belt too, so he got what was happening. And I got to take him make the direct amends, and after it was over, he said, oh my God, Carla, that's long forgiven, long forgotten, and I just can't believe you're still alive. And he's right, you know. I think if we're in this room this morning, we're the lucky ones. Lucky one more time. You know, I don't know, I spent a lot of time when I was new, and I still, my whole life is a meditation and a prayer. I stay awake to the nudges that the Spirit might give me. There's a power, I often call it the power that is. I don't call it a he or a she necessarily, except to make it short. I don't think there is a gender to God. God is always changing and getting bigger, or my concept of God is always changing and getting bigger, and that's okay with me. Our book says we don't have to be able to define or comprehend that power, which is God. But I get fascinated by it, you know, like, And so if you're having trouble with step two can just be the word maybe. You know, by the way, here, step two is just maybe. Maybe this will work. I look at how does a tree know how to be a tree every single time? You know, and my latest one, you know, I was watching this National Geographic thing or something, Discovery Channel, where they were doing a whole thing on sloths. And you know, those sloths, those cute little animals that hang and they move really, really slowly. You know, but they're adorable. All of their intestines are connected to their rib cage because they hang upside down all the time. And if they didn't, they would suffocate. You know, all their intestines would just run up and they couldn't breathe. And I think, what kind of smart power, what kind of beautiful inherent power would create that kind of a circumstance? I mean, you know, and of course there's so much obvious going on, but I just thought, yeah, look at the sloth, man. There's a power. So anyway, I digress. But that was a long time to come. And I left Hollywood and I hooked up with another guy from another rehab because, you know, that's where they keep the partners, the boyfriends and girlfriends and whatever it is you're looking for. And you know, I always loved the idea of peace and love and all that stuff, but we just couldn't stop knocking the heck out of each other really long enough to implement the principles fully of peace and love. And so we beat each other up and down the California coast and pitched a tent in the mountains in southern Oregon and lived there till the rains came. And, you know, I'm just the kind of a drunk who sleeps by the side of the road and calls it camping. You know, I think I'm on a spiritual quest and I'm a hobo. And so the rains came, and then our friend who lived across town way up another mountain came and invited us to live on his mountain, and he lived up the hill in the plastic tent. He was our spiritual advisor, and there was this old mining claim, this old beat-up log cabin that had no roof, so we threw a plastic tarp over the top, called it a skylight, and then the baby came. And I thought having this little girl was going to change the way I drank, you know. And I had had enough therapy to know that you got to break the cycle. You got to become the parent you never had. You got to be better. You got to do it different. You know, now I'm getting my clothes and shoes and the necessities of life out of a box behind a store in town, and I think I'm going to be a better parent than the one I had. Because I'm delusional. And she got in the way of one of our fights when she was about 10 months old, and I had to take her up the road where it's got to be better somewhere else. And up until then, I'd been a little bit institutionalized, a little bit unable to get out into the marketplace, but now it's do or die, right? I got to take care of this little kid. And so, and I wanted to. I really wanted to. In all my delusions, I wanted to be a good mom and stuff. And so my first legitimate work was in the bar business. And it never occurred to me not to drink on the job. Why else would you have that job? It just seemed to me to be cosmically efficient, right? It just all seemed to work together. But I made good money. I worked in nice places, and I still couldn't bring home enough money to pay rent for more than a week at a time. So we lived in the rent-by-the-week motels, and I drugged that kid from pillar to post and all over three states. And we ended up back down in L.A. I was renting a room from my aunt in Covina, and I had a job in Hollywood tending bar. Again, not a bad place to work, making great money. Me, I'm the common denominator. And every afternoon, I'd kiss my daughter goodbye, who was almost 4 years old at the time, and I'd take off for the job in Hollywood, and I'd get thirsty about halfway, you know, and I'd pull in onto Huntington Drive in Arcadia and park in the parking lot of the first cabin and walk in there and belly up to the bar and ask for a couple of shots of gold and Budbacks and drink my drinks and get up and go do my shift in Hollywood and crawl home in the wee hours of the morning and start all over again. And one afternoon I kissed my girl goodbye like I had done for months on end, and I took off for that bar in Hollywood. Again, got thirsty, just like every day, right about Huntington Drive, pulled in, same first cabin, same shots of gold, same Budbacks. And to this day, I don't know what was different on that day from the day before, except for 24 hours, because I did not hate the job I was going to, and I didn't love my daughter any less on that day than I love her today. But I sat on that bar stool this day, and I drank those drinks, and this time I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop long enough to get up and go take care of business at work, and I couldn't stop long enough to go back and see about the kid. So I sat on the bar stool and I lost them both in one fell swoop. The kid and the job were gone. And I stayed and I lived off the kindness of strangers there in that little area in Arcadia for about a month until I fell into another job at another dive bar. And I had to stop calling the kid to find out how she was doing because she kept asking me those hard questions like, "Mommy, when are you coming to get me?" And I had no answer for her there. In fact, I thought in my heart of hearts, she's better off where she is. And that went on for a few years. And I met and married my drinking partner, thinking maybe if I made my life look like yours did, maybe if I just, you know, put it together on the outside, we'd be okay, you know, move indoors for kind of a permanent amount of time, and he and I got married about the time we should have split up, and we became the neighborhood entertainment. We settled our arguments with a shotgun. Whoever got to the gun first won, and that's how we did it. And my first exposure to AA, I went into my first AA meeting with black eyes and broken ribs again and again and again. And my friend, I have a friend who says that it wasn't so much the yes that bothered him, it was the oh no, not agains, over and over and over again. And so I went to this AA meeting and I heard the woman share. I don't remember all of what she said, but I know that she said that somewhere during her drinking career she switched to beer. So I did. I thought, the representative from Alcoholics Anonymous seems to highly recommend it. And after all, beer's not really drinking anyway, was it? You know, I didn't think so. And I thought, you know, it's got wheat and hops and barley and really kind of like a whole grain breakfast food, you know, if you ask me. And so, and it gave me the illusion I was controlling my drinking. You know, it allowed me to get a little further into my day before I fell apart completely. And so I did that for a while. And I got the kid back when she was 8 and a half, and I didn't get sober till she was almost 10. One more Saturday afternoon, the cops are in the driveway one more time, and the neighbors are watching us one more time, and the kid's standing in the corner one more time, scared to death. And I can't tell her it's going to be any different. I didn't know how we got there in the first place. Nobody woke up that day saying, let's do this. So the cops left. They took the gun. The husband left for the last time. It's me and the kid and the booze, and I can't stop drinking. And here's where a hard drinker might take a look at their life and say, you know, I'm tired of this. Hard drinker might have to get up and even go to detox for a week or two. Hard drinker would come back home. They'd go back to work, have a story to tell if somebody asked them, but they would move on with their life. That's a hard drinker. Given sufficient reason, they can get up and move on with their life. But me, as an alcoholic, I just pull the 12-pack closer to the couch so I don't have to keep getting up to go get another drink. Because I drank through the circumstances of my life. I drank through drug addiction and homelessness and anything else. I drank through it all. And I was getting ready to drink through this. And my first sponsor told me if I wanted to affect a conscious contact with a power greater than myself, I could start by counting the coincidences that happen in my life. You know, those situations that seem to fall together for the good of everybody without me having my hands on it. And the first one I could count was that I had moved in next door to a woman who had 5 years of sobriety. And she saw and heard this whole thing and came over a couple of days later and brought me a big book and a 12 and 12. And she sat on my couch and she told me her story. And in her story, she never talked about me. She talked about her and her drinking. And in her story, I could tell she drank like me. And over the last year, I'd seen with my own eyes that she wasn't drinking anymore. And what impressed me more about that was it didn't seem to bother her that she wasn't drinking. And that got my attention. I don't know how you do that. Because when I've got no booze and I've got no steps or fellowship or God of my understanding, and I didn't even know about those yet, I feel like you stripped the coating off my wires. I feel oversensitive and underloved, and I don't know what you meant by that or why you looked at me that way. And my self-centered head closes in on me from there. So much so that even though I know a little bit about the booze that I've been drinking, I never knew about the physical allergy, the allergy of the body. You know, I never bellied up to a bar saying, hey, Joe, you know, the obsession of the mind to drink alcohol has been on me all day, so you better pour me a couple, you know. But watch out, you got to stop me at 4, because that phenomenon of craving is going to kick right in and I'm not going to have any. I never knew that. I just know I need a drink. So even though I knew what I knew, even though I knew that I no longer had to invite trouble, it seemed to come to visit unsolicited, right? My friend Kent says he knows that if he were to take a drink, he's about 25, 28 years sober, and says he knows today if he were to take a drink right now, a cop would fall right out of the ceiling. You know, it's just going to happen like that. And even though I know that the window of relief has gotten really, really small, you know, 20 good minutes, half an hour, you know, and that's all I'm going to get. Even though I know all of that, I know that eventually I'm going to have to go back to that first drink and it's going to take the next. And I'm going to be right back in that, right back in it. So I didn't know how her 12 little thinly veiled Sunday school sentences were going to have any effect on me in the face of what I've become. You know, we've heard them all before. These are not new. But I had to, you know, like a lot of my friends say, you know, I didn't come here because I saw the light. I came in because I felt the heat. You know, I had to be desperate enough to take these uncomfortable actions and to think that maybe these silly little principles might do something. And all I had as evidence was you guys walking around. So she, my friend, left, and it was about a week and a half. I just didn't go back and buy any more booze, and I got sick. You know, I shook it out over the weekend and saw and heard things that weren't there, and shook into Monday and shook into Tuesday, and by Tuesday afternoon I was stark raving sober. But instead of going to the store this time, I went to my neighbor and I asked her what to do, and she sent me up to a meeting in Sierra Madre, California. That became my first home group. I went up there and I sat way back by the open door and the exit sign just in case, you know. You guys all seemed a little too social for my taste. You know, and to tell you the truth, if I could have come in here and stolen what you had and taken it home and done it myself, I would have. But I had to be here. You know, and still to this day, I always say, you know, the steps drive me into the fellowship and the fellowship drive me right back into the steps. That's how it works. You guys are my examples and my catalysts. And I am yours. I'm your comfort and your discomfort. Yay! But I heard, you know, people being very nice to each other, you know, asking each other, "How you need a ride home? How's that fourth step coming? Did you get a big book?" Stuff like that, you know. And, "Hey, Joe, how's your lawn?" Like, what? Your lawn? How's your lawn? What do you mean? You know, and it occurred to me, I mean, I got a little bit moved, you know, thinking, oh my God, can my life ever be so elegant and simple as to be concerned about a lawn? You know? Like, up until then, my life seemed to have been so much about foraging and scraping and holding on and trying to keep it together. Like, how beautiful might it be if I could just sit back on a porch and smell fresh cut grass and be okay? Damn, I still like that. And I'll tell you, if I were to take a drink, I wouldn't be so much afraid of dying as I would that scrapey little life. That inch by inch by inch by holding on and trying to eke out any peace of mind whatsoever. And hold on to that for just a nanosecond. I don't want to go back to that. The secretary asked me to read at the end of the meeting, and I took the portion of chapter 11 that we read at the end of a lot of meetings, A Vision for You, and I read it. And as I read, I came into the room just a little bit more, just like I do every time I say yes to something you ask me to do, to read or lead or pick up a newcomer, pour coffee, make coffee, wash coffee cups or ashtrays, dump the trash, mop the floor. One of my favorite lines in the Big Book is that what seemed at first a flimsy reed turned out to be the loving and powerful hand of God. And my whole sobriety is built on flimsy reed after flimsy reed after flimsy reed. How many times did I say, what the hell does that have to do with staying sober? You know, I might not have even said it out loud. I might have thought it at you. And then I made that first round of amends to my family at about 9 months. And that's about when the obsession to drink alcohol was finally lifted from me, and it hasn't returned. And then other women started asking me to sponsor them. And I got to tell you, the only fifth step I like better than mine is yours. Because in your eyes, I see no stupid questions. You know, I see hope and growth and redemption and forgivability where I don't always see it in myself. And you draw from me, like Amy said, you draw from me the things I don't even know I need to share or that I have experience sharing. And then we start talking and I go, oh my God, I used to be there and now I'm here. And you can too. Holy crap, just like they told me. They told me I could do this too. See, the thing about this is, you know, this is my privilege and my responsibility. And we each get... Our founders didn't write this book, you know, the old timers didn't write this book and say, hey, if you do what we did, you'll be able to call somebody one day and they'll have a sister who had an aunt who had a spiritual experience. They didn't say that. They said, if you do this, you get this. And that is my privilege and my responsibility, because you cannot do it for me. I can't sit back and let you do it for me. Now, sometimes I get a lot of grace. There may be some days where all I've got is 60%. It feels like 100 to me. You look at it and you go, damn, I hope she makes it with the 60%. But the difference between my efforts and perfection is God's grace. The grace that I've been afforded by staying close. And, Bill says this a couple of times, maybe more than a few in our book, is that it is that the right use of my will is to look, to see, to try to align mine with God's. You know, to try to align my will. So there is some will involved in this. There is some try. There is some discomfort. One of the best things I ever learned in here when I was new was to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. That's the grow zone for me. Even all these years later, you know, I get uncomfortable. I'm like, okay, get comfortable because we're going to learn something. You know, but I don't have to be afraid of it anymore. You know, I'm not doing something wrong necessarily. I'm getting ready to learn something. You know, the awakening has to continue. But I had to come to trust this process. And that happened in the first 9 months or so. And then even then some. You know, maybe the first five. I mean, I'm continuing to learn to trust more of the process. But to get to know it and then to continue to use it in my life. After a couple of years, I'd had you guys and my daughter didn't have anybody. She's 11 years old. She's 18-year-old vatos are crawling in and out of her bedroom window and they're partying. You know, I'm getting calls at work like, are you authorizing this party? She's coming home at all hours of the night, beat up and bloody. She's been jumped into a gang and starting to find her sense of family out in the street. And it was time to get her some big help. You know, she was really, really mad. And I'm right up front in our book. It says on page 19. It doesn't wait till later. It says a more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our homes, occupations, and affairs. If I'm only doing it in these rooms, I'm only half doing it. And I'd been going to 2 and 3 meetings a day and being so active and going to work and, you know, paying rent for more than a month in a row and all of that stuff. But it was, you know, this kid needs me. So I had to stop going to 2 and 3 meetings a day, go to 1 meeting a day, go to work and go home and be a mom to that kid. That was where we started. And then I put her in a treatment center for about 6 months. And that's where you guys taught me that mountains are moved a spoonful at a time. You know, I showed up when they asked me to and I stayed away when they asked me to. And they told me, too, that at that age that the gang influence was 1,000 times more toxic than drugs and alcohol on kids that age, simply for the effect of, I got your back. You know, that's what she was looking for. Her mom didn't have her back. She had lost her mom to alcohol, then she lost her mom to AA for a while. And it was time to change that. And I'm not saying not to go to meetings. I'm saying I had to stop going to 2 and 3 a day. You know, and go home and be a mom to the kid. If I'm not taking this out into the world, this is not meant to stay in these rooms. This is where, as my friend Carl says, we huddle up in here and then we take this out there. You know, this is how I got it. One of my pet peeves, if you want to hear my pet peeve, did you bring a pen and paper about my pet peeve? But, you know, is to hear people say, like, well, too bad they don't have out there what we have in here. Not true. Here is where I get to go do what a lot of them have been doing for a long time. You know, here is where I got the chance to stand on my feet sober and continue to wake up. So a lot of those out there already have it knocked. They already got it going, you know. When she came back out, you know, from the time she was about 11 till she was about 23, we had, you know, a long period of reconstruction ahead. And it's hard to wrap up, you know, 61 years of living before and after sobriety, you know, like in 1 hour, you know, like some bad episode of Law and Order, you know what I mean? We got Law and Order and boom, we're good, you know, and that's it. Woo! And the newcomer's wondering, how the hell did that happen so fast? You know, where's mine? What's going on? But there were ups and downs along the way, you know. There were 2 steps forward and 1 back and 1 forward and 2 back sometimes, you know. When she was 16, she and her boyfriend sat down in front of me. I told them they were pregnant and they nodded. And I got to tell her I'll be there no matter what. And I got to be present at the birth of my first grandson. And he just turned 24 and he finished his first year of law school. And then the youngest, he's 18, he just finished high school. You know, time has passed. And But it took some time. And it doesn't just happen overnight. It's not magic. It's consistency. One of the best things you ever taught me was how to parent through the guilt. You know, it would have been so easy just to leave it alone and not try. It's too hard. You know, but life is messy. Like Amy said, you know, life is messy sometimes. It comes at us. It comes up. It's not just us, anybody. people get sick and, you know, all of that. But you guys gave me a foundation to stand on. 12 steps, 12 traditions, 12 concepts. My whole being, my whole life stands on this foundation. At 5 years of sobriety, I came home from the gym one night, went to bed after a time, and woke up in the middle of the night to a man standing over my bed with a knife to my neck and his hand over my mouth, and he said, "Don't say a word or I'll cut your head off." And he took the telephone cord and he tied my hands behind my back and he raped me and he robbed me that night in my room. I got to tell you, at 5 years of sobriety, I had a much bigger trust in a God that I didn't understand. I also understood it wasn't personal, necessarily, you know. It wasn't being done to me. You know, there wasn't, I don't have a God that shoots things at me to see how I'm going to do with them. I don't have that God anymore. But this guy, you know, he stayed for a few hours. And then we got into a little wrestling match and he ended up going out the same window he came in. And it turned out I knew him. I'd actually watched him get sober 30 days before I did. And I watched him get his life, his wife, his kids and everything back. And then I watched him join the church and leave AA behind. And when he went out like that. And what I chose to learn from that is that while the big book tells us to be quick to see where religious people are right, this is the place where I learned the terms and conditions of my alcoholism. This is where I learned that I'm not one of those people who can go home after a Sunday sermon and have a glass of wine. This is where I learned to remember that. In church and synagogue and temple and all of those places, we talk about spirituality, we address spirituality, we grow spirituality in a very general way. It works for everybody. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, we take spirituality and we aim it right at alcoholism. It's our one single primary purpose. And it works good. And then so many of my other problems got better too, you know. And there was a trial that followed, and as part of the defense, they had a lot of the guys I'd known years before get up and testify as to who I used to be. So we had to get a character witness for me. And by that time, I was working at a big fancy investment firm downtown Los Angeles, a place I never would have walked in the front doors of years before. People like Henry Kissinger walked the halls of this place, and now I'm walking undetected because I show up, I do what they asked me to do. I had really the equivalent of about a ninth grade education when I got to AA, and you guys just taught me how to show up. And so the department head volunteered to come and testify on my behalf, and they told him all about who I used to be, and he said, "Yeah, but she shows up early and she stays late, and she was where she said she was." And that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. And then it was my turn to testify, and I'm sitting in the witness stand, and up until then my sponsor was reminding me that I was going to have to forgive this guy, and I know she's right. I know we're people who can't handle even seemingly justifiable resentments. But the guy had scared me, and anger was still my favorite way to address fear at that time. But I needed a lot of help with the 7-step prayer that became my mantra, because I couldn't be angry, I couldn't not be angry, and I knew I needed to let it go. So I'm sitting in the witness stand, and I look out and I see him sitting at the defense table, and that's a place where I've sat before and I could sit again. If I were to take a drink, I could be sitting in his very seat. And that prayer at the top of page 67, when right in the middle of the resentment inventory in our big book, talks about, though we didn't like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they like ourselves are spiritually sick. I have to remember, they like me. He like me is spiritually sick. That if I were to take a drink, I could be sitting in his very seat, maybe for not rape, but something else. And that to be reminded that forgiveness is never going to come from a spiritual hilltop or a place of superiority. Forgiveness comes when, and compassion comes when I'm standing on the same playing field and I realize it could be me, that you are me. And it slows me down, that prayer slows me down all these years later. You know, it slows me down when I want to get really self-righteous, because I got to remember when I'm getting ready to get a big huff and puff going on, I got to remember that I could be, have been, or am being right now in some area of my life exactly who I'm pissed off at right now. And to put it in even more simple terms, my friend Larry Peterson used to say, when I'd complain to him about some dastardly deed that somebody was doing, he'd say, "Yeah, but don't forget, that's not going to look any better on you than it does when you're doing it, than it does on them." So anyway, I realized that the forgiveness came in that moment. The forgiveness came and the healing took about another year and a half or so. And then, you know, remnants come up and then I deal with those too. But I learned that I could forgive and hold somebody accountable all at the same time. It was for me to testify and it was for me to forgive, all in that same seat. And when he was sentenced to 20 years, and when it was over, the detective who worked the case came to me afterwards and he said, "I don't know who you were back then, I'm not even sure I want to know, but whatever it is you're doing now, keep doing it because it seems to be working." And that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. And you know, again, trudging this road, I've had some really, really great joys and some really, really hard sadnesses. You know, I mean, people live, people die. We try things, we fail. We try things, we succeed. That's life. And man, it's just such a thrill for me to be able to do that. Just to walk out and be a person. You know, and I just never thought that that was going to be quite good enough for me. You know, I thought it was going to have to be something way more magnificent. But my life and getting to watch the people around me, the women that I get to sponsor, the people who want me in my life, want me in their lives, you know, is amazing. My daughter now, she's 41 years old, and just a few years ago we sat with my husband and my mended family and watched her collect her master's degree. And she's a clinical social worker who goes in the aftermath of events like the Las Vegas shooting and stuff like that and helps the people, the victims, put the pieces of their lives back together. Now that's who she is. And I don't know if she is who she is because or in spite of me, but because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I get to be a privileged witness in her life and in the lives of anyone who wants to be in mine. And I think that's pretty cool, you know. If you heard nothing else tonight, or that I say this more tonight, it feels like tonight, I'm going to go back out and go to sleep. But if you heard nothing else, just know that this is yours if you do it. You know, it is yours. We all get a spiritual awakening if we do this. It's one way. And for me, it's one that's been proven, one that'll work for you too. Thanks for letting me share.